This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. John Wheeler, WDAY's chief meteorologist, offers a deep dive into historical weather patterns, the impact of climate change, and the evolving technology in meteorological forecasting in this conversation with Prairie Pulse's John Harris in an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show.
John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself. You've been around here a long time, but where are you originally from?
I was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. My upbringing was largely a feature of my dad's education. He was getting his master's degree in math at LSU when I came along, and I don't remember Louisiana very much, but we then moved to Alabama, where I did my early growing up. My dad was a teacher at a preparatory school in central Alabama, and my mom taught public school. Then he decided he would get his PhD when I was about 11 years old, and we moved to Wisconsin. So then I became a Midwesterner, and I finished my high school years in Iowa, in northeast Iowa, where my dad was working in education and curriculum development, and my mom was a high school teacher and play director. And then I went to Iowa State and got into meteorology as a career and worked at one station in Iowa, but most of my time has been spent right here in Fargo, North Dakota.
This past winter, one of the mildest on records. Tell us about that. How does it rate historically?
You know, that's a good question. I would first point out the word historically, that when we talk about, you know, the warmest ever, what we really mean is the warmest on a period of record. And weather records in North Dakota, preliminary records go back to, Bismarck has the oldest continuous thermometer record dating to 1875. Fargo's pretty old, 1881. Other places started later. And of course, over time, there are more and more instrument sites. So when we talk about the old records, we're getting our information from a very small number of sites, and now we have a great many. But this basically stacks up as the warmest on record, certainly one of the warmest by any standard. And it's not just the winter, but the fall, winter, and spring so far stacks up as the warmest observed.
And the previous winter, 22-23, was a bad one compared, but I guess most of them were bad compared to 23-24. So in your view or what you're hearing, does this mild winter sort of forecast more mild winters, and is it due to climate change?
That's another very good question. And I think a lot of people are confused about the difference between climate and weather. Weather is the daily weather. And here in North Dakota, you can't count on the weather being the same one hour to the next, much less one day to the next or one winter to the next. So we have a great deal of built-in natural variability of weather in our climate. So our climate presupposes a lot of variation. So the fact that last winter was cold and this winter was very mild doesn't really mean that much, because that's just the way our weather works. Climate is the overall pattern. And we find climate change in North Dakota weather records as we see things change over time. So one warm winter doesn't really signal anything. There have been warm winters in the past, maybe not quite as warm as this one, but there have been warm winters in the past. And the fact that, as you pointed out, last winter was kind of a bear of a winter suggests that maybe we're living a little too much in the present if we use just this winter to say there's something that's gone wrong with our weather. Climate change is found in the way that changes begin to manifest themselves over time. We see an increase in this weather feature or a decrease in that over the course of years and decades. That's where climate change is.
What do long-term models suggest? Well, let's just say for this summer, in terms of temperature and rainfall, do weather patterns say, you know, we have dry seasons, wet seasons, but what does it suggest for this summer?
I'd like to point out two things there. One is that when you're talking about models, again, there is a distinct difference between weather modeling and climate modeling, because the physics are completely different. And by the way, it's kind of interesting. The best computers in the world today are the fastest, most sophisticated computers in the world today are used in two arenas, spying and military, weather and climate. Those are the best computers we have. So we're putting a lot of money into this. What a weather model does is it takes the current observations, the atmosphere at the moment, and uses physics to predict how those conditions will change over time, increment by increment. That's not what a climate model does. A climate model takes the world or the region and then changes the inputs, the various things that impact that climate, and then comes up with sort of what averages would be like into the future, or if you wanted to construct it, what are the averages of today based on the conditions of years ago? You can run that as a test. So the two types of modeling are distinctly different. And when you talk about what are the models suggesting for the summer, the mathematical physics models that we use to predict the weather over the next few days start to lose their reliability once you get a week or two out. We can do other things to look at a couple of weeks out. But when we're talking about the upcoming summer, what we mostly look at are large-scale weather anomalies around the world. What is the sea surface temperature doing? Where are there pockets of unusual weather right now? Where are there various circulation patterns around the world that might have an impact on the jet stream and general weather? And then we can use that to predict with a certain amount of vagueness what a summer would be like. But nobody really knows what the summer is going to be like. We can just look at all these inputs. I think the suggestion is it's probably going to end up being a little bit warmer than average. And I think there are a number of indications that suggest it might be a little bit drier than average. I did not just say there's going to be a drought, but that seems to be the trends that I'm seeing.
Talk a little bit more about the scientific evidence out there that maybe is suggesting a warming of the planet. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Let's get away from the word true. When I'm talking about weather, as a scientist, we try to pull back from truth and get into fact. That's with the understanding that facts are a little bit transient. Facts change as new evidence and new ways of testing facts and of methods come into play. I think everybody needs to understand, though, that the idea of climate change did not begin with somebody observing a warming and let's find a solution to this. Going way back into the 19th century, scientists observed that there was a dramatic increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that this change in the physical chemistry of the atmosphere must have some effect because of the greenhouse effect. And so the idea that we might be warming the world by burning fossil fuels is not new. It's been around a long, long time. Finding evidence for it and supporting it and trying to predict the future of it, that's relatively modern.
So what is your opinion of extreme weather patterns of, like we just talked about, one bad winter to one mild winter?
Well, you know, an interesting thing about North Dakota weather, the state cold temperature record of 60 below at Partial, North Dakota, the coldest temperature ever measured by an accepted standardized instrument, was in February of 1936. The hottest temperature ever measured in North Dakota was at Steele of 121 degrees. And that was in July of 1936. So the coldest and the hottest temperatures in the state happened in the same year. And 1936 is way before we got really excited about climate change. So our weather has always gone from this extreme to that. So again, where do we find evidence of climate change? We find it in things that are a little more subtle to observe. For example, if you look at any weather station in the state of North Dakota, 20 below nights, they're happening at about half the rate that they did 100 years ago. If you take a 5 or a 10 year running average, any given winter can be cold or not cold. Any given winter can be mild or not mild. But if you take like a 10 year running average, there'll be more winters in the last 30 years that feel more like this one. They're a little harder to find 100 years ago. Summertime, the difference is actually shows up more with humidity and the nighttime temperatures. We find that because our weather here in North Dakota has generally, as it has over the last few years, grown a little wetter, think of the floods in recent years, we're adding more humidity to the atmosphere. And there are a number of reasons for that, and it's not all climate. Some of it has to do with the fact that we're growing some really robust crops of soybeans, and evapotranspiration actually puts water vapor into the air. We see in the summertime those warm, sticky nights. Those nights, I use 65 degrees as a benchmark. Nights that don't drop below 65, those are happening at about twice the rate now over a 5 or 10 year running average than they were 100 or so years ago. All of this, you have to look at the data. And I've always been I'm a natural born skeptic. So what's wrong with the data before you start jumping to conclusions? Almost all of the long-term weather stations in North Dakota are in cities, and those cities have grown. And so there's a certain amount of heat that comes from tarmac, particularly in wintertime and particularly at night. So we notice that the nights don't get as cold. to some extent, because instead of a bare field covered in snow in winter, we've got a bunch of parking lots, and that gives off a little bit of heat. Not only that, but we have all these buildings and cars that are giving off heat. So there's a certain amount of the warming that you have to realize is actually urban-based. And there's a certain amount of the warming that we measure that comes from plants, that comes from evapotranspiration. If the dew point is higher, it doesn't get as cold as night. But you can sort through all of that. You can look at dew points in wintertime. You can look at rural weather stations like the North Dakota Ag Weather Network stations, which are entirely rural-based out in fields. And you can still see that there is a climate change in North Dakota. There is a definite warming. And over the last 100 years, the rough estimate is about half of it is natural and about half of it is probably due to greenhouse.
What are the potential dangers of a slowly warming planet?
If we get fewer nights of 20 below, a lot of people would say that's not a bad thing, right? The danger is change, and climate can change naturally too, and does. For example, look at the Devil's Lake area in North Dakota, which I remember I did a speech up in Devil's Lake in the spring of 1992, and at that time there was a lot of talk about putting in a pipeline to the Cheyenne River to get water into Devil's Lake, because the fishery was really suffering because the lake levels were so low after the drought in the 80s. And of course, that recovered dramatically in the 90s, and it's still very high. Recovery isn't a great word. It's been a blossom, right? Devil's Lake is a good way of looking at how our climate can change. There are some human factors, you know. Farmers in the spring work their fields so that we can get moisture out of the soil a little more quickly for a little more planting. That's not the reason Devil's Lake is flooding. The main reason is that we're getting more rain than we used to, but there are some natural things too, like ditching and straightening of rivers and tributaries and that sort of thing. But in the bottom line, we can still see that there has been a definite change in the climate, and some of it is very clearly caused by greenhouse. What are the dangers of it? You have to think globally, first of all. It's getting expensive. Most Americans live within 25 miles of the coastline, and the coastlines flood. And as the ocean rises, as glaciers gradually melt, those floods get more expensive. And eventually you have to do what we're doing in Fargo. You have to keep the water out. You have to build up or pull back, and that's very expensive. Decades from now, agriculture may look very different in North Dakota because of the change in climate. It looks quite different now than it did when I got here in the mid-1980s. We don't grow much barley anymore. We grow a lot more corn. Our soybeans look thick and rich, and all of that is, there are all kinds of agricultural changes. Some of that in the future will simply be because as the warming continues, we're going to see changes in yields based on the climate. For example, in the last few years, yields are fantastic. Part of that is because as our summers have warmed, our rainfall has increased. Model projections into the future, decades from now, not next summer, not the summer after that, but decades from now, are that the increased temperature will be such that evaporation will dominate the increase in precipitation. And so at some point, you will start to see basically our state getting drier. That will then force probably some different agriculture than what we see today.
Tell us about your job and how you forecast. How has technology really changed how you look at weather patterns?
I got into this when weather modeling was still very simple relative to today, but I never had to try to forecast the weather without the models. That was back in the 70s and before. I started weather forecasting in college in the early 1980s. The models weren't very sophisticated, so we had to learn to do a lot of forecasting based on analysis of conditions, which I think has helped me, because kids today, young meteorologists today come out of college with these computers that say, give you a map of the world, and these are all the temperatures in all the cities and what they'll be hour by hour. And, we didn't have that. One thing that I try to do, I try to keep our WDAY forecast an entity unto itself. So that is to say, if you watch us in the morning, the forecast for Saturday afternoon, the high temperature Saturday afternoon, is going to be the same no matter which show you watch throughout the day, no matter which meteorologist is presenting, unless we as a unit agree to change that forecast. We try to hold that forecast entity as a continuum. That way the audience knows what we are thinking about. We're not reacting to the latest model whim I think that provides a little more consistency. And we forecast storms in the same way. We get together in our office, we talk about it, we decide what a storm is most likely to do. We stick to that forecast, and then if we're going to change it, we change it as a group. And so if you watch us today, tomorrow, the next day, if the forecast has changed, it's because all of us have decided to change it. And that's hard to do.
What's the worst weather you recall in your years of working at WDUI? You've had different ones, I'm sure.
Worst weather or best weather, right? Why does a meteorologist get into weather? It's not for nice days. The most memorable weather to me was a period of about 3 weeks in the winter of 1995-96, which for probably most North Dakotans is long forgotten because of the winter of 96-97, which was an epic winter and then the great flood of the Red River. But the winter before that was a beast of a winter. And there was a blizzard in January. My youngest child was born just as that blizzard was getting started. We brought him home just as it was really going crazy. It was one of the worst blizzards that I've ever seen, in that it was so cold. I think we ended up getting about 18 inches of snow in Fargo, so it was a bad one, with winds up around 40 miles an hour. But most of that time, the temperatures were in the teens and 20s below. And then the 2 weeks that followed that were just all below zero, just the coldest stretch of weather I've ever seen. That was remarkable.
Any advice to people who might want to get into this line of work that you're in? And where can they go to find out more information?
Well, in this line of work, be prepared for change because, you know, it used to be everybody watched the weather at 6 and 10 and the media doesn't work like that anymore. So be prepared to find different ways of reaching your audience. And as far as finding information, there's a lot of information out there, but be careful. The internet is an ugly, ugly place. I do write a daily piece in the forum that is, sometimes it's informational, sometimes it's opinion, but I try to put a lot of varied information in there. And if you read that every day, hopefully you'll at least know what I'm thinking about the weather and climate.
Well, John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's
been fun. A lot of good information. Thank you.
That was WDAY Chief Meteorologist John Wheeler with Prairie Public's General Manager John Harris in an excerpt from a recent Prairie Pulse television show. You can see the Prairie Pulse television show on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Central on Prairie Public Television. More Main Street is ahead.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra will perform its final concert of the 2023-2024 season this Saturday and Sunday. The concert is titled American Celebration, and we visited their offices in Fargo. Joining me to discuss is Chris Zimmerman. He is the longtime music director for the FM Symphony Orchestra. This concert is this Saturday at Reinecke Hall, Saturday and Sunday, on the campus of North Dakota State University. You've been rehearsing. What's special about this concert?
It's American Celebration is what it's being billed as, right? Let me tell you a little bit about how that came into being. Two of the pieces on the program were featuring Jeffrey Beagle, who is a great pianist. He's been here before. He came about 4 or 5 years ago. And he's particularly well known, I think, and I applaud him for this, for creating commissions for new pieces. In other words, he commissions composers to write new pieces for him. He's tireless in this, and he's all sorts of well-known American and European composers have written for him. In this case, what he decided was, this year is actually the 100th anniversary of the creation of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. And Jeffrey had the, I think, inspired idea of trying to get someone to write a kind of companion piece to that. American composer Peter Boyer has written, after Jeffrey's commissioning suggestion, a piece called Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue. Very national, of course, nationalistic, I suppose you might say, which is not at all the same as the Rhapsody in Blue, but it's inspired by, and it has many jazz elements and many dance elements of the era of the 20s when Rhapsody in Blue was written. We are featuring both those pieces. Now, the Boyer could, of course, be played on its own. Indeed, well, I say is, it's only just been written a few months ago. But Jeffrey has performed it on his own. But the fact is, he likes to make it a companion piece with this. And that's what we're doing. So we're performing these two piano concertos, if you want. They're not called that, but that's what they are. And I thought, okay, so two American pieces, one of them absolutely iconic, the Gershwin. Why not create an American program? The other two pieces on the program are also iconic. Bernstein, Leonard Bernstein's suite from the film On the Waterfront, and Aaron Copland's very, very, very famous and very beautiful Appalachian Spring, written for the Martha Graham Ballet Company. So we had these four, repeating the word, three iconic pieces and one brand new piece inspired by.
There's a movement to perform Rhapsody in Blue in all 50 states. What's behind that?
Well, that's right. So thank you. I was going to remark on that. Thank you for reminding me, though. Beagle, Jeffrey, made it his mission. It was his impetus. He's amazing, tireless, to try and get this piece, Peter's piece, performed, hopefully alongside, but certainly Peter's piece performed in all 50 states. And about 6 months ago, I think he'd reached about the 42nd, but I've heard very recently it is indeed being done in all 50 states. So it's fantastic.
His performance of Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue, this is a North Dakota premiere.
Yes, it is. So we are the orchestra doing it, I'm proud to say.
What have you taken from this concert season?
You know, I like to think all the concert seasons are kind of successful and special, certainly when I and we try to come up with a season. I like to do premieres, but in this case, I think we've done three or four, and two of which are world premieres. So that is special. And it's great to have the chance to, for all sorts of reasons, but, you know, not least to give a new piece. Beethoven's Fifth had to be done once at some point. It's crucial to do this. And also to work with the live composers and have them come. Now, they haven't all come this season, but some have come. And the last concert, for instance, where we talked, you know, one of the composers came all the way. She's actually Vietnamese, but she lives in Paris. She came from Paris to witness the premiere of her piece in this country. That's, you know, all this communication and cross-global international communication. I think that's great.
Chris, you're known for your pre-concert talks. Those will happen with this set of concerts, April 20th at 6:45 p.m., Sunday, April 21st at 1:15 p.m. Those will be in Beckwith Recital Hall, which is just across from the concert hall. Again, what's your motivation for having those pre-concert talks?
Well, thank you for saying I'm known for them, I hope in a good way. And I think I have had feedback that people do enjoy them, which is great. You know, when I got here, actually, there was always to be a kind of pre-concert lecture of some sort. And then having given a couple, I was advised on this too, I won't pretend it was just my idea, that it seemed that it might be better if they were, not that they were technical in any way, but that if they became maybe even more casual. So what I've grown into now is basically me sometimes talking on my own about the program in a very audience-friendly way, you might say, and expressing my interest and enthusiasm about the music and trying to put the pieces together in a coherent whole for the listener, just giving them some sense. I also do that a bit from the podium before some of the pieces, if I think it's warranted. But actually more than that now, it's become a way of introducing the soloist or soloists. And so the audience can kind of get to hear a bit behind the scenes what's going on. And even if it isn't a soloist who's coming in, for instance, this time Jeffrey will be there for sure with me. Last time we had all sorts of soloists and composers. We had about six people on stage. But also sometimes I actually bring in an orchestra member to join me so that he or she can talk about whatever the subject may be. It is kind of behind the scene. Relaxed atmosphere, and people don't. And when it's a soloist, I try to ask questions about, you know, what's their life like living out of a suitcase, if that's what it is. And so, you know, because I think most of the audience don't really know. They see these people perform. They obviously realize we're all human beings, but I think they like the fact that it's a little bit, you know, less formal. They can ask, and it's all open for questions.
The pieces are Rhapsody in Blue, Rhapsody in Red, White, and Blue, Appalachian Spring, and On the Waterfront. All will be performed this Saturday and Sunday, April 20th and 21st, Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. from the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra. Performances are at Reinecke Concert Hall on the campus of North Dakota State University. Music director Christopher Zimmerman has joined us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg with Craig Blumenschein here in the Fargo studio.
Ashley, good to join you.
We still have coming up here a somewhat chilling movie review from Matt O'Lean, Civil War. The name sounds like it would be a movie about the actual Civil War that happened in the 1800s, but it's actually more an exploration of the culture wars going on in the U.S.
This is one I kind of want to see. I've seen information about it.
Yeah.
I saw an interview with, I think, Kirsten Dunst,
yeah,
who's in the movie.
It's an interesting trend that I feel like you're starting to see in movies, talking about the divisiveness that Americans are feeling and what might happen if we don't learn how to talk politically.
I'm thinking we've all seen movies about the Russians coming to the White House and,
yeah,
taking over, and terrorists coming in and taking over. But this is about us against us, it seems like.
Yeah, that gives me chills to hear you say that.
It really does. Well, we'll look forward to that movie review with Matt, like we always do, and Dave Thompson, Ashley. He and I will review the news, everything from marijuana to air taxis to the politics of the state are on the docket for us to discuss.
I can't wait to hear about air taxis.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little town.
And it's time for our weekly review of the news with Prairie Public's news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you today?
Doing fine, Craig. How are you?
I feel like we're pitching a doubleheader here. We had
John
yesterday talking about the governor's debate coming up. We'll talk about that here again in just a moment.
Absolutely.
But Dave, I want to lead off with a notable passing this week. North Dakota's former Lieutenant Governor Lloyd Omdahl, he passed away at age 93. What role did he play in North Dakota politics, Dave?
Well, as Lieutenant Governor for Bill Guy, he was very influential. As a Lieutenant Governor, you also serve as the head of the Senate in North Dakota. You chair the Senate. And that was, again, the case when he was the Lieutenant Governor for George Sinner after Ruth Myers passed away. Lloyd Omdahl was one of the NPL people, and he had a profound influence on a lot of things that have happened in North Dakota politics. Plus, where I encountered him a lot was as an instructor at UND when I took political science classes there.
So you were his student?
I was his student, yes.
Give me a sense of his personality, Dave.
Wonderful sense of humor, wonderful sense of history. And yeah, we knew what his political bents were, but you know, he didn't let that get away, you know, in the way of teaching classes. So what I really liked about him was his style and just the fact that he really enjoyed his students, that students really enjoyed him.
And he continued writing a column for the Grand Forks Herald for quite a long time,
right,
after he quote-unquote retired. So this is a politician North Dakota will miss. Do you
Absolutely.
Agree with that?
I do definitely agree with that.
All right, let's get on to a review of the news this week. A legalization effort, it's not the first, aims to get ahead of legalizing marijuana here in the state of North Dakota. Surrounding states, Minnesota and Montana, have been through this effort and now have recreational marijuana legalized. What's your thoughts this time around?
Well, it's kind of interesting because of the way they're approaching this. They're approaching this as a grassroots North Dakota effort. And the chairman, Steve Bakken, who is a former mayor of the city of Bismarck, is now on the Burley County Commission, he said he wanted to gather a group to get ahead of it so that you could put the North Dakota spin on it so it wouldn't be an out-of-state group that would impose their will on the state of North Dakota. So it looks like he's got a number of business people, some politicians, and some others who are working on this with him. He does have a bit of a pretty good lift because he's got a deadline, and it's a July deadline, to get it on the November ballot.
The North Dakota Way was in your headline, Dave. And when I thought about this, look, it's either legal or it's not. So what's different about the North Dakota Way?
The North Dakota Way puts further restrictions on it. If you look at Minnesota's law, ours is going to be a bit more restrictive and with a few more things attached to it than who can possess, how much you can possess, how many plants you can grow.
Dave, the group is called the New Economic Frontier. Are they banking on this to be a significant revenue enhancer for the state of North Dakota?
As a matter of fact, they are. They're talking about that right now, and they're saying that that's a way you can tax marijuana and you can make a little money off it.
On to nuclear power, Dave. The Commerce Department has now begun to study whether nuclear power could be used to help meet the increasing demand for electricity here in North Dakota. This takes me back to my days in Wyoming, Dave. As you well know, they are looking at and are implementing smaller form nuclear power plants starting in Kemmerer. What is the story here in North Dakota?
Well, you're looking at increased demand for electricity, a lot of it being driven by these data centers. There are a couple data centers in North Dakota. And there are other projects in the queue, but they do need electric power. And coal-fired plants are really hard to, you know, get permits for these days. It might be a little bit easier to get a permit for, like, the small nuclear 50-kilowatt plants, something like that. So Commerce saying, we're going to take a look at the Wyoming example, see how they're embracing it down there, and then bring it to North Dakota and maybe embrace it here as a way to add power.
Is this initially, as it's being discussed, supported, do you think?
Well, it's a good question, because I was talking to members of the Public Service Commission, and there were two things that came out of that discussion. Number one, they need to have an educational effort to make sure that people know what it's about, that we're not talking about Three Mile Island and those big cones, or even in the Minnesota nuclear plants, that they're talking smaller nuclear facilities. Randy Crispin, who chairs the Public Service Commission, says, first, you have to take a look and see where you're going to dispose of nuclear waste, because that is an issue. And that's why he said some of these projects haven't gone too far, because they haven't found places to dispose of nuclear waste, and said, once you get that answered, then we can talk about siting and things like that.
Just a blast from my past, Dave. Wyoming looked at monitored retrievable storage years and years ago, and it was progressing well until the governor, Mike Sullivan, a Democrat at the time, put the kibosh to it. He was most concerned about not the storage, but the transportation of nuclear waste to where it was planned to be stored, which was for Wyoming in the middle of nowhere, essentially near Shoshone, Wyoming. All right, Dave, let's move on. The University of North Dakota Aviation Dean has said air taxis could be the next growth area for aviation. It reminded me, Dave, of a story also from Wyoming. Former Senator Michael Von Flattern, he's a pilot and also owner of an air charter service. He once told me, there'll be a time soon, he said, when there will only be a pilot and a dog in the cockpit. Pilot's job will be to feed the dog. Dog's job is going to be to bite the pilot if he touches anything. This is what that reminded me about. Are we really getting down that road?
In a way, you are, because talking to the dean of the aerospace school at UND, he said there is really a lot of development on these air taxis, and they're hoping to maybe have air taxis available in Paris for the Olympic Games. He said that that might be a bit of a stretch, but he said North Dakota might have a little issue with getting permitted, but North Dakota trains pilots, and these can either be piloted aircraft, or they could be what they call now uncrewed aircraft or unmanned. Yeah, and UND is very involved in that and would like to get some demonstration and some training projects here in North Dakota.
I'd love to be part of that demonstration team. The thought of an air taxi is appealing to me.
Well, think the Jetsons.
Dave, there's a debate next Tuesday. Of course, we talked about that yesterday, a Republican gubernatorial primary debate. Mm-hmm. That's at 7 o'clock here on Prairie Public Radio and also on Prairie Public Television. And as you noted yesterday, online here at prairiepublic.org. Dave, how significant do you think that Governor Burgum's endorsement of Tammy Miller is in influencing the outcome of this race is where I'd like to start here.
You know, that's a question I've been pondering and pondering and pondering, because there are those in the Republican Party who really do like Governor Burgum and his ideas about business. But there's a faction of the party that just doesn't like him as well. Kelly Armstrong's been around for a long time. Tammy Miller is kind of a newcomer. But I go back 8 years when Burgum was first elected, and he defeated the popular Attorney General Wayne Stengem. And he defeated it by outspending Stengem and, in some respects, out-negative. His negative ads kind of helped that along, too, because, you know, you're seeing some negativity in the Armstrong and Miller race. I just don't have a handle on this yet to see who might be coming out in a primary to vote. And I think it takes it down to that level. It's your get-out-to-vote effort.
Interesting. Yeah. North Dakota was worst in the country of difference in voter participation from, I believe, the 2016 presidential election to the 2020 presidential election. So hopefully that can be reversed. Dave, have you noted any policy differences between these two candidates? Is one more centrist? Is one more perhaps to the right?
Well, this is where I think it's going to get interesting, because we're going to get into a lot of policy discussions at the debate. We'll probably learn a lot more where people are at in terms of policy. They both are energy supporters, and they both are looking at the legacy fund and what to do with the earnings from the legacy fund. So it'll be interesting. Need to drill down a little bit deeper, and I'm hoping to during the debate.
Dave, what else are you working on with your news team?
Well, here's one fun story. I find it fun because we were just talking about nuclear power. MDU, which is Montana Dakota Utilities Company, was formed 100 years ago and was actually headquartered in the Twin Cities, but it was power produced for North Dakota and South Dakota. It's become a pipeline company. It had construction companies, and those construction companies have been spun off into their own companies. So they're going back to kind of like their core business, which was electric power and pipelines. They were in the coal mining business for a while as Knife River Coal. That's gone. I think it's going to be just kind of fun. I had a chance to talk to Nicole Cavisto, who is the CEO, and she did talk about the idea of going back to the core.
Dave, before we go, I want to remind our listeners that the debate will be at 7 p.m., the gubernatorial debate between the two Republican candidates for governor. Mm-hmm. That's at 7 p.m. next Tuesday here on Prairie Public.
Central time.
Central time. Good point. And also, there will be perhaps other debates that might include the Democratic candidate as well after the primary election. Is that what you're thinking about, Dave?
Yes, absolutely. Working on that right now, trying to get things set up. So when we find out who the Republican nominee is going to be, we'll get the Republican and Democrat in the studio as well and talk about it. Matt Olean is helping me on the debates, you know, and AARP is involved. So we're going to be setting up political debates. You'll find political debates here.
And Prairie Public will be live blogging during these debates
correct,
as well.
Yes.
People can go to our website to check that out. Dave, it's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Thank you, Craig.
Matt Olean is next. He reviews Civil War, a chilling story about potentially what might happen someday in America. Or at least let's hope not. That's next. Stay with us.
The Fargo-Moorhead Choral Artists conclude the 2023-2024 season with Holding the Light, a concert including repertoire around the focus of light in our worlds. Saturday, April 20th and Sunday, April 21st at Trinity Lutheran Church in Moorhead. Ticket information can be found on Eventbrite or through fmchoralartists.org.
The fanfare, that means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, you've gone to see Civil War, which, judging by the trailer, is not about the actual Civil War.
No, it's about a hypothetical Civil War that, let's face it, has been chatted about online and in the news media for, you know, the last 4 to 8 years. And so this film, written and directed by Alex Garland. He's a British filmmaker, most notably directed Ex Machina and Men, the Jesse Buckley horror film that I liked a couple years ago. So he's a skilled director, and he's crafted a kind of dystopian vision of the United States engaged in a civil war. And the film moves very quickly. There's some intense battle scenes that we witness, and it's really seen through the eyes of four photojournalists who are in the midst of this war trying to get from Pennsylvania to Washington, D.C. To figure out what's going on and to chronicle all the battles going on. Kirsten Dunst plays the main photojournalist. She's very good in this role. Kaylee Spaney, fresh off her performance as Priscilla Presley. In Priscilla, plays a young wannabe photojournalist who tags along with the others, played by Wagner Moura and Stephen McKinley Henderson. So along the way, there's a lot of excruciating battle scenes. They're very well done, Ashley. It's like you're right there. And that's the point of the film, is to give you a sense of what these photojournalists are doing, what they're chronicling. It's intense. The fighting scenes are amazing. The film is really short. It moves along at a breakneck speed. But despite an initially strong weekend at the box office, I think it's a film that kind of in the end lacks some big ideas. So It's so nonpartisan and so by the book. There's even a speech by Kirsten Dunst in the movie where she tells young Kaylee Spaney, you got to stop thinking. You just have to react and do this. And we as journalists, we can't, if we ask too many questions, it's going to drive you crazy. So, and that's how we were all trained, you know, growing up when I went to UND Journalism School. But I think the film needed one more scene to explain what's going on. What are the two sides? Who are the secessionists? Why is the president serving a third term, which was, you know, in violation of the amendment? Nick Offerman plays the president.
How is he in a serious role?
He's barely in it. You hear his voice a lot, saying he wants the Western forces to surrender. Another thing I was confused by is apparently Texas and California are part of these Western forces, secessionist groups. Texas and California would never be aligned in anything, hypothetically, if this ever came.
It's hard to imagine those two coming together.
So I don't know if Alex Garland, being British, didn't realize this when he was writing this film. He wrote this film back in 2020. I just think I don't want a preachy film banging me over the head. But I also want a film which had more exposition. I think it needed one more scene, Ashley, of exposition explaining how we got to this point. And they just kind of throw you into the mix of the four photojournalists documenting the war, documenting the two sides. What's going to happen? What's going to happen when they get to Washington? Are they going to get an interview with the president? Is all hell going to break loose? And it's all well done. It's very well executed. It's a very good film. But I just wonder, you kind of leave the theater going, who are the secessionists? Who is Jesse Plemons? Jesse Plemons shows up in this cameo role as a militiaman, which is the most tense scene in the whole movie. But you're kind of like, what side is he on? Because it's very confusing, and I think it needed just 5 or 6 more minutes of exposition. That's what I would have done, just to give us the stakes. Give us the two sides.
Sure.
What's going on? Right.
You know, you use the word preachy, and it sounds like there's potential here for someone to come off as sort of blaming. Does it seem like the director is coming out on one side of the culture wars or the other? Or is this just, this could happen?
I think it's a could happen movie. He's definitely sticking right in the middle on what he thinks about what's going on. I'm not sure. And I'm not asking him to take a side. I would just prefer to know how we got to this point. That could have been done in some very quick exposition with a 4 to 5 minute well-written scene, or Dunst could have explained it to everybody or explained it, even though they all know. Some sort of exposition, I think, is needed here. It just kind of leaves you with a sense of, did it stick the ending? Did it stick the landing once the film ends? And I kind of think they didn't quite stick the landing either. So it's a partial success in terms of, this is really good filmmaking, and you are scared watching this. You're scared for the journalists. You're scared for young Kaylee Spaney, who looks like she's in over her head. And you know, as this young photojournalist, Dunst carries the movie for sure. She's very good in the role. Wagner Moore is very good. Stephen McKinley Henderson's very good. He's a veteran character actor. It all kind of works on very much a tactical level, a technical level. But I just think it's a film that skirted around the big idea.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, too, because as we've been talking about culture wars and sort of exploring them for the last few years in particular, but a couple decades, if depending on who you ask, journalists were covering it. And now it sort of feels like journalists, there are many people who think journalists are the cause of, or certainly exacerbating, the culture wars. Is that explored in the film?
That not really. And again, Garland really plays it very neutral. And so you can't really tell where he's coming off. Now, yes, we know there are media out there that are on the left, media on the right. You know, I like to find the media that's in the middle and make my own decisions on these things. But he doesn't really, again, doesn't really tip his hand there as well. So I think there's a different movie to be made here by someone else, possibly. This just wasn't it. But it's very solidly made. If you want to go and kind of be a good citizen and watch this film and kind of see what's going on, like, this could happen. Because it feels some days when we watch the news like this could happen. Like, it's very possible. Charlottesville is even mentioned in the movie. They're going to Charlottesville, where some forces are gathering there. But again, just kind of the aligning of Texas and California as Western forces makes no sense to me. But the Jesse Plemons scene is really tense. So that's a really tense scene when it comes. He's uncredited in the movie, by the way, but it's him.
Okay. Yep. Kind of an easy trivia, or I assume an easy trivia for you this week. Kirsten Dunst, you said, lead actress in this film, born in 1982.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she went on to be nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So we're going to go with Best Supporting Actress in the year she was born. So Oscar year 1982, which would then, of course, be film year 1981.
Maureen Stapleton wins for Reds. Jane mm-hmm. Fonda nominated for On Golden Pond. Oh, my goodness. Joan Hackett, Only When I Laugh.
Yep. Got the film Ragtime.
Oh, Elizabeth McGovern and, for Ragtime.
And An Absence of Malice.
Oh, Melinda Dillon.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Viva La Italia, the final season concert of the Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra is set for Sunday, April 28th at 3 p.m. The program, titled Italian Serenade, features excerpts from the comic opera Elixir of Love, with guest artists soprano Melissa McCann and tenor Sebastian Habotsky. The orchestra also presents serenades full of Italian lyricism, drama, and energy. The concert will be held at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church in Bismarck. Tickets are available at the door.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 18th. Fargo and Moorhead were first settled in 1871, and by 1874, the area's first newspaper debuted, the Fargo Weekly Express. Over the following decades, a plethora of newspapers went in and out of publication. The Fargo Forum was founded by Major Allenson Edwards on November 17th, 1891. Another local newspaper, the Republican, published since 1878, was purchased by the Forum in 1894. The Fargo Forum and Daily Republican went through many owners and some financial hard times over the following decades. On this date in 1917, only a few weeks after the United States entered World War I, the Fargo Forum and Daily Republican made a startling announcement. Norman B. Black, the publisher of the Grand Forks Herald, had purchased the Forum. Norman B. Black was born in Ontario, Canada in 1865, moved to Wisconsin in the 1880s. As a young man, Black went back to Ontario to work for a newspaper. He soon returned to Wisconsin and became a publisher for various newspapers. He also became involved in politics, serving as the state factory inspector in Milwaukee. Black eventually made his way to Minnesota to work for the Minneapolis Paper Company. In 1906, he moved to Grand Forks, where he eventually consolidated two newspapers into the Grand Forks Herald. Perhaps ready for a new challenge, Black, along with his son and two associates, offered the current owner of the Forum $100,000 for the paper. Black handed over $100 to the owner at a meeting at the Gardner Hotel, then rushed to New York to borrow the rest from a bank. This risky move proved to be worth it. Black was an astute businessman. When he purchased the Forum, it was an evening paper published 6 days a week. So in 1924, he purchased the Fargo Tribune, which became the morning and Sunday edition of the Forum. In 1926, Black constructed a new building to house the Forum, which remains the paper's headquarters. Norman B. Black contributed generously to the Fargo community. He was a charter member of the Rotary Club, gave to many charities, and donated a pipe organ to the First Presbyterian Church and Concordia College. He was also well known for his singing voice and enjoyed curling. He died in 1931. His descendants still own the Fargo Forum. This Dakota Datebook, written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Thanks for listening today. Tomorrow during the 3 o'clock Central Time slot with Jeremy Hobson, it's The Middle as they discuss legal weed and how that's going for states. Interesting as that maybe could end up on the ballot in North Dakota.
Very
in this
topical.
Election year. Yes, and during the 7 o'clock time slot, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato.
And Monday on Main Street, Ashley, we're going to offer a global perspective. The fish in Norway are starting to act strange. This is a show about the seafood we eat and the impact on our world. Remember, Norway shares its northeast border with Russia. That's Monday on Main Street. We hope you'll be with us.